Thanks very much for your questions. Michael, I have a playful answer, of course, and a more serious one. You get both. So the playful answer is you asked me whether I'm perhaps only using or perhaps even abusing poor Karl Polanyi and I should be developing him. If you ever assign book reviews to your students and you say, you know, you should start to learn how to write, best is you read somebody else's work, you try to get his or her message and then you try to comment. And then the people, your students will keep coming back to you and say, did I get it right, did I get it? And then you will tell them, an author never writes a reader's book. That's one thing. So also Gulliver's Travels, you know, about what is that book? Thomas Morris's Utopia, about what is that book? Is it a country? Is it a critique of a certain time? Robert Ellison's book is not about Order Without Law. It's not about California. It's the reference book now for social norm. So that's a playful answer, and that's okay. The more serious answer is that when I said I'm talking about these things as a lawyer, as a continental lawyer, and that of course is not very interesting for people that are not lawyers that did something else with their life, but as a continental lawyer, you're not only determining your academic career, whether you want to be a public or a private lawyer, but you also are confronted every day with the reification of legal discipline and legal doctrinal terminology to explain how the world should actually look like. And the world, of course, doesn't look at all like the terminology that we employ. And so the idea here to use such a book that that is of interest, as we all know, for many, many different people, and there was a CBC program in Canadian broadcasting a few years ago on Polanyi's work, and they quoted a professor who said that she never knows in what household and in what library she finds Polanyi's book because it's everywhere. So if I now as a lawyer take that book, then I find the political economy description interesting, but now I translate this into my legal agenda today, and that is the point about transnational law. So if one takes a transnational perspective on doing legal regulation today, one finds that there are, of course, a lot of attempts still to have a national agenda of how to regulate, you know, la pêcherie, maybe. Or it looks like it's a national agenda, but regulatory fields have long ceased to be national agendas. Just one little example. So for 10, 15 years now, we think that corporate governance systems are converging. That means that the European countries all seem to be under high pressure to adapt their systems, knows that it's not attracting capital because it has co-determination. Now, many attempts have been made to change co-determination by going to Berlin and having a law passed. It's very clear that you cannot legislate against co-determination. It's too holy, it's too embedded, it's too characteristic, it's the example for German capitalism. Now, at the same time, co-determination has already been deregulated in an incredible powerful manner because it's transnational regulation of corporate governance by now. So one is you outsource it to a private expert committee. The private expert committee will draft a list of recommendations of how to improve German capital market law and German company law. It will also then create a code, and that code has the following formulation. The code says that it's best practice if shareholder representatives meet in the supervisory board, if they meet separately from the employee representatives. Now that's a de facto erosion of an effective system of co-determination. And now the tragic part about this is that we've always had that practice. Everybody knew that co-determination is more than anything else symbolic in German corporate governance. But now the code that wants to improve corporate governance, that is a private quasi self-regulatory instrument, says this is best practice. And this is driven by German corporate lawyers and French and Dutch corporate lawyers all going to Europe and sitting again on the European Corporate Governance Forum and saying it's really important to see that we have difference. So we all have our national histories and we're already proud of them and we celebrate la différence. A whole set of recommendations, of suggestions, of proposals that are all, like Antoine just pointed out, they are all very soft. But they're really powerful because touchy fields today are mirroring the denationalization of capital. So regulation still for lawyers looks very national. It makes a difference whether I study law here or somewhere else. But in fact, the way that regulation is being put into place is highly transnational now. So it takes place in a field that's much more difficult to govern politically, because what would be a political critique of the European Corporate Governance Forum? Because it didn't harm anybody, it just made proposals. But those proposals go into the eroded regulatory systems in all these different countries, because the governments, of course, will never be caught red-handed. No government actually puts an axe to these highly historically grown systems. Lastly, the CSR agenda. So CSR is the famous court jester that comes into the room. So we continue to have a debate whether we should regulate corporate law in the European way, that is, we have hard or soft law, we have hard or mandatory law, or whether we do the American model, we have enabling law. The court jester comes and says, we won't have any of that anymore. We'll just have corporate social responsibility. Under CSR, we now identify what the different regulatory areas are that are connotated with CSR. So there are labor rights, human rights, environmental responsibility, but there's also fiduciary duty, there's also society responsibilities. Once you begin to extend that catalog, you actually talk about what the corporation really is, which is a dramatically functional approach. You incorporate all that debate about economic theories of the firm, but you take them seriously now by saying there are those aspects, but there's also the other aspects too. I'll just call them all CSR. And as you recall, after Enron, the banner in front of which Bush was saying we now have to talk about the responsibilities of corporation, it didn't have social in the word. The talk was only about corporate responsibilities.
Sure. Let me, first of all, thank you for the wonderful comments. Let me try to offer a couple thoughts briefly so we don't run too much over on time. I'll try to take the questions in reverse order, and I think by and large I agree with the thoughts and the critiques, but let me just offer a couple thoughts. One around this issue around punishment and so forth. I think I wholeheartedly agree. Let me just offer just a couple additional thoughts on that. One of the debates that's going on, at least in the U.S., is to what extent the managers, given that they have indemnification clauses, director and officer insurance, business judgment rule protection, and other more esoteric protections, to what extent there's any really punishment that will affect them other than criminal punishment. So that's one of the arguments would be to actually increase criminal sanctions, and to a large extent that's why securities has been more effective than corporate law. The other argument I'll just mention here, because I've gotten into debates with people about this, and I'm sure you're more familiar with this perhaps than I am, there's a whole school of thought, at least in the U.S., that basically says, you know, we really can't regulate this using public law. Right? This is the kind of stuff that you learn when you're a small child around the family dinner table, and all you lawyers that are going out there talking about public law sanctions are essentially tilting at windmills. My counterargument to that is availing force to negative norms. Okay. In terms of the market as a black box, I think I agree there as well. The only thing I'll say, and I stand to be corrected on this, is at least my knowledge, which is not great in this area, but I compare the amount of literature that's been written about the market in economics to the amount of literature that's been written about the firm, and there's a huge difference. So market may be a black box, but at least it's there are a lot of forests have been... Yeah, around, now, we may say it's incomplete, but there's certainly, if you think about sort of a classical economics education, we spend a lot of time talking about markets, whether it be micro or macro, and very little time talking about the firm. Yeah, but not to diminish in any way from the point. Now, with regard to the neoclassical and the aggregation of problems, again, there I agree. Just a couple of things, and I think it may reflect more my ignorance than anything else in this area. I have not read Vernon Smith's new work. I'm familiar with his work in experimental economics, but I haven't read his work on theory. In terms of Hayek, at least as my understanding, to a large extent, whether for good or for ill, his work has been used not so much as an aggregation theory, but essentially as a mechanism to justify decentralization in sort of 19th century liberalism, as opposed to sort of a more proactive aggregation theory. I think your point on neoclassical, I completely agree. I think, and I have to sort of, express my own, among many, but one of my shortcomings here, is I think what has happened, at least the area that I'm in, is in law and economics. And what people such as Richard Posner and Henry Mann and others have done is they've taken a very simple neoclassical model. Very often, and hopefully the economists will agree with me, what's done in law and economics is about 50 years behind what you all are doing in economics today. Right, so they take Calder Hicks from 1939, it's laughable, right? So it's a reaction of using that to try to explain everything in the law, right? So I think it's a counter-reaction to that. But in terms of elegance and simplicity, I think there's no question. And there's a lot you can do. And the other argument here, and I think maybe it's more a pedagogical one, but I always argue with my students about this, is in order to deconstruct the neoclassical model, you have to understand what it is first. You can't just jump to behavioral. So I think that's a point there. Now, the firms, the points here that were made about firms and cooperation predating the market and so forth, I agree. I think along a couple dimensions here, I'll say. One is that there's at least new work that it seems to suggest, very much along the lines of what you have articulated, that, for example, let me give one example. In the U.S., the dogma for a long time has been that the boards function somehow as a disciplining quasi-market mechanism, and it's efficient. There's now new evidence to suggest that, in fact, from a path dependence point of view, the boards of directors essentially evolve from European guilds, right? And we sort of have taken that from Europe in the United States without giving it, you know, so it's not necessarily efficient, maybe more path dependent. But I would agree that the firm exists because of cooperation. Now, the point the professor made just about employment contracts and cooperation among workers, this is so interesting. I think that there is a huge area for cross-continental research here, because at least I'm not an employment lawyer in the U.S., but in the U.S., we talk very little about cooperation with workers, and we talk very little about employment contracts. The economists do. Right, writing in the economy, but not the lawyers. In fact, the joke is in employment, in most of the cases in the U.S. are employment discrimination cases, because we've given up this notion of employment as a property right. It's basically everyone's an employee at will, unless you're lucky enough to have tenure at a university, basically. So I think, agree. Now, in terms of the moral judgment and whether someone is guilty, I think that's right, and I appreciate those comments. I'm not saying that they're wrong, but there are certain moral judgments that have been made effectively. Interesting also about your comment, it opens up a huge area, but this whole intersection of law and morality and whether they're essentially congruent or not. But I think I appreciate the comments there. In terms of the first comment, first of all, in terms of commons, I was both unclear, at least unclear. The only point I was trying to make with commons is that usually when people talk about transaction cost economics, they go back to Coase. My only point was you have to go back to commons, because commons actually predated Coase. I think there's an article, I think it was a Wisconsin Law Review article or something that he wrote before Coase. And in fact, Coase cites them. Of course, everyone cites back to Coase. Now, with regard to the very first question about norms and where they don't exist, let me offer sort of a couple thoughts off the top of my head, but I need to really think about that one. So one of the arguments, and in the spirit of maybe a sort of a more humorous response, would be someone say, okay, fine, let's assume norms are everywhere. The law essentially tries to regulate everywhere. Let's conceptualize it as a series of norms. Let's think about the most pernicious norms and try to design countervailing public policy against them. So I'm not sure that's fatal to the argument around norms. Now, there's another one I'm still struggling with, I'm just thinking off the top of my head, which is to argue that sort of an Alexonian kind of way, which is to argue that if the law already clearly regulates it, that's less norm-like, and we're more interested about the areas the law doesn't touch. I think that's a little messier. I think probably the most simple, more direct answer would be to say, fine, bring it on, right? Let's deal with it.